geometrically, the shapes that the female naked body give are better than the shapes the male naked body gives. I mean, essentially what I'm saying is that I prefer spheres to cylinders. Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Worst Foot Forward, the podcast that each week celebrates the best of the worst. I'm Ben Vanderveld, and this week you find us strutting the catwalk as part of Worst Foot Forward Fashion Week. As a part of our high-cost, low-cut, mid-range, bad-taste, platinum couture Emperor's New Range that is heading straight to a TK Maxx bargain bucket near you, our models, each one of which has been topped up to the back teeth on Belarusian cocaine cut with washing powder, are wearing the most innovative designs. Our first model, Kiki Sophia Romanoff-Carling, is due to wear... Kiki Sophia Romanoff-Carling is, due to a clerical error, wearing three Basque separatists... a sleeveless gannet and Jim'll Fix It shorts. Coming up next is Sebastian Postlethwaite Umberton showing off his remarkable body in a see-through tweed three-piece complete with visible herringbone genital gym sock. And last of all, legend of the modelling game, Sticky. Wearing our cutting-edge catsuit made of the tattered remnants of Rebel Wilson and James Corden's credibility. And with me is the lager to my fields, the Vivian to my Westwood, and the cocoa to my pops. It's Barry McStay.
That's great. Yes, can you do that again for like the rest of the show?
That was beautiful.
All right, happily.
Yeah.
You're a well-heeled man of fashion.
You take that back. That's an Edwardian slur for homosexuals.
All right, you're a glumping scarecrow who looks like he's been dragged backwards through Primark.
That's a gay slur for Edwardian dressed heterosexuals.
That's fair. And if you ever sort of like bought any proper high-end fashion?
I mean, when I got, I don't know what high-end fashion is. When I got married, we bought our stuff off the rack in Ted Baker. We went for Ted Baker. So I quite like Ted Baker. That's like the fanciest label I would buy regular stuff from.
Oh, that's it. As your best man, I bought my waistcoat and trousers from Ted Baker, and 5 years on, still got them. Still the priciest things I've ever bought.
Yeah. I'm glad we made you go to that length.
I made you. This wedding is not about me and Mikey. It's basically an intervention on behalf of your wardrobe.
We went to my older brother's wedding earlier in 2019, and it was black tie, and obviously as it turned out the only homosexual couple at this thing, you basically look like you'll be twins dressed by your parents when you come dressed in like matching tuxedos. So I was like, I'm going to make sure that I wear a different tuxedo. So I went and tried on a lot of nice fancy floral numbers in a few places in Piccadilly, and ended up buying quite a nice thing from there, just to create a little bit of differentiation between the two of us.
Yeah, no, that's important. You'd like, because otherwise, I mean, I can imagine you and your husband in matching tuxedos would look like a pair of Ukrainian secret agents.
or we could stand at the side of the church and heckle like Statler and Waldorf.
Yeah, you totally could. I'd just like to make it known to any listeners from Eastern Europe, early doors in this podcast, you know, I have nothing against your countries.
He buys all of his cocaine from Belarus, apparently. Listen, let me introduce our guest. Our guest this week is an experienced and award-winning theatre director with a flair for new writing. In 2018, she was named number one on the stage's Top Talents to Watch. We can only apologise for podcasting being an audio medium. Her credits include Anguis, the first play by Olivier Award-winning actress Sheila Atim, and 100 Words for Snow by Tati Hennessy, which, following award-winning success at the Vault Festival 2018, embarked on a UK tour and a run in London's Trafalgar Studios, where it received 4 Off West End Award nominations, including Best Director and Best New Play. Yeah, she's good. She also directed work by past guests of the show Camilla Whitehill and Tristan Bernays, and by current host of the show Barry McStay. Yep, she directed my play Vespertilio at the Dublin Fringe and Vault Festival 2019, where it won Show of the Week Award. But I don't like to make a big deal. This is her intro. She's currently developing a host of new plays, most notably Something Awful by Tati Hennessy, which ran at Vault Festival in January, and Meet by Jill Greer, which has just opened at London's Theatre Theatre 503. Coincidentally, Meat and Something Awful were the names Ben and I were called in one of the kinder reviews on this show's iTunes account. Anyway, please welcome... Anyway, please welcome a director whose own rave reviews have more stars than the Milky Way. It's Lucy Jane Atkinson.
Hello.
You're right.
Oh, good.
I have to remember to put the Jane in your name. Because you're professionally
Lucy Jane. It's very
important. But I
get,
just call you Lucy.
I get pissed off if people don't use it in a really petty way. Like,
are you a Lucy Jane, or is Jane just your middle
Jane's
name?
Jane's my middle name. Yeah, it's a family name. My grandmother chose her own name, and it's now become a family name for the rest of us.
Was your grandmother... I already think she's some sort of excellent suffragette battle axe.
More like a sort of Calamity Jane figure. Oh, wow. Like she was christened Ida Virginia.
And she had a what?
Yeah. And her, like, she grew up kind of on army bases. My great grandfather was relatively high up in the American army, and she really hated her name. So they would move every year or two, and she just rock up with a different name and refuse to answer to anything else. And by the time she was about 12, she'd settled on Jane, and she was Jane for the rest of her life.
I love it that your grandma's backstory is like the one that Bob Dylan made up for himself. Yeah. And everyone was like, where do you come from?
Exactly that.
Like, yeah, I used to hang around with the carnival and the boxcars. Also, it's a real honour to have the great grand order of General Eisenhower on the show.
Yeah. I don't like to brag.
Yeah, but, on behalf of my ancestors, thanks for liberating Europe.
Did you always want to be a director? Did you go into theatre? Like, some people end up with it via acting or other stuff.
No, I very much always wanted to be a director in a really, really wanky, precocious sort of way. Like, I've told you my origin story before.
Yeah, you have, but I'm teeing it up for the listeners.
Yeah. It's grotesque. So I grew up just outside London, and in 1997, when the Globe opened, my parents... bought tickets to like every...
By the way, Lucy means the Globe Theatre.
The Globe Theatre. Not
the signing of like an
global
trade deal.
We got like standing tickets to every show. And I vividly remember as an 8-year-old seeing Mark Rylance playing Henry V, which was very cool. And the things that blew my mind were not his performance so much as the fact that Pistol stole a hat from someone in the audience. And the actor who played Boy also played Kate. And I didn't realise until the jig at the end, and my mind was blown. And I was like, someone told them they could do that. Basically since then, like, I didn't want to be the person doing it. I wanted to be the person telling them to do
that's,
it.
That's so telling.
It's, oh, yeah.
Were you there as well watching it? Because I remember when I first decided that I wanted to have a proper good go at acting, was going to see a student production and thinking, oh, I can do much better than all of you. and the same with stand-up. So I think that every performer has that in them, this idea of this is all well and good, but it's not the Vandervelde way.
Yeah. Yeah.
Were you there sort of like going, like, Rylance is good, but he needs some notes.
I mean, like, he's just wafting around. Yeah. No, right from 8 years old, I was like, I could tell him to do that better.
There's nothing wrong with a deliberate waft.
Lucy has a great, having had work directed by and having been directed by Lucy, she has a great style of working where she makes you think you've come to the decision yourself.
Psychic trickery.
Then you look back and you realise she's Derren Browned you to fuck at the entire process.
Yeah, that's exactly how it works. Yeah.
That's good. Well, yeah, as far as I can see, there's two sorts of way of being a director. They both involve being the puppet master, but only one of them makes people realise they're being puppeteered.
The other one, it's the other one who shoves their hand up your arse.
Oh, yeah, it's either marionettes or it's glove puppets.
Yeah. Michael Bay is glove puppets.
Yeah.
And Lazy's marionettes, Lucy.
Clearly, we've seen, Lucy, that you are an extremely adept director, but what are you worst at in the world?
Cooking and multitasking. Which
one is essential in the other, isn't it?
Yeah, which, you know, I'm very, very bad at both, and I think they feed into each other a lot of the time. I'm very good at becoming, like, insanely focused on something, that then if anything else is going on, I cannot split my brain out of it.
Yeah.
And with cooking, you need to be multitasking kind of the whole way through, which is why I have no interest in it at all. I just find it incredibly stressful, and then you spend like 2 hours making something and it tastes like shit, and like yeah, I just don't see the point. I don't see the point. I can't wait for food to exist in pill form and just like be done with the whole endeavor.
This week, we have decided to go down a slightly different, but quite theatrical route for you.
Yeah.
In terms of, we're talking about the world's worst fashion show.
Yes.
You're quite a fashionable lady of that.
Oh, thank you so much. I try.
Why fashion shows?
I just fucking love them. Like, I have a real deep passion for, like, high stakes, low stakes things. So, like, having just, like, devoured Cheer or, like, watching Last Chance You or, like, basically things, again, where people get really, really laser focused on something that, like, really doesn't matter that much.
Getting to regionals in Glee.
Yeah, exactly. All of that. I'm just like, I just die for it. I absolutely love it. And I think like high fashion, like haute couture, is exactly that. Like, it means nothing.
Yeah.
But people, like, the artistry and the creativity and the passion that goes into it is just like a complete other level. And I think there's something really fascinating about that, and how people can get so deep into something that they convince themselves it's a great idea. it just makes me so happy. Yeah, I love it.
That's fair.
Frankly, you are too enthusiastic for this podcast.
I know, I'm so
but
sorry.
It's all right, but I'm looking forward to finding out what is the opposite of your enthusiasm for haute couture. Yeah. But before we go there, Barry, what horrors of the catwalk did you discover?
Well, first things first, I didn't realise most fashion shows are only about 10 minutes long.
They are, yeah.
About 5 to 20 minutes are sort of the limits of probably what they'll be, but they're obviously around 10 minutes.
I mean, that's fair, because when you think about it, it's just some men and women walking up and down looking like they don't want to be there.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, but also, there's only so many clothes someone can, I'm using air quotes, invent in a year.
I love it if all the chat like at Milan in 2020 was going to like, have you heard about Gaultier? He's invented a new kind of jodhpur.
Because I don't know how long it takes to walk, maybe 15, 20 seconds. So that's like, and there's not one person doing it at any one time. There's usually a couple of people. So that's maybe 12 items or 10 or 12 items of clothing a minute. So once you're up to 10 minutes, that's a lot of clothes.
It's a lot of clothes.
So I wasn't aware of that. I also like the fact that in the early fashion shows, basically they didn't have photographers at fashion shows because they were paranoid that other people were going to steal their designs.
They also just used to do fashion shows, like they just invite like people who already bought stuff from the brand and just show them in like a living room. Like, it was so it was really intimate and casual in a way. And now it's like, you cannot get in.
I like Elsa Schiaparelli. She showed a collection on a catwalk at the Saks, the shop in New York, in 1931. And obviously, as at that time, photographers weren't allowed. So the collections were sketched by artists, like courtroom artists.
Yeah.
And also, I read about the most watched fashion show in history. Do you know what this is?
What was it?
It's Yves Saint Laurent in 1998, just before another very important event in 1998... The World Cup final.
Oh my god, yes, the World Cup. Yeah.
So before France played Brazil in the World Cup final, basically they had like a pre-final show, as they often do. They have like bands playing music or children wear papier-mâché heads and walk up and down or whatever. And so they had a one-off Yves Saint Laurent runway show inside the Stade de France where the final was being played, because it was just celebrating, I think, its 40th year.
Mm.
Basically, they had 300 of their best looks from previous shows gracing the pitch.
Amazing.
That is the most French thing, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, fashion and sport together. They needed 900 backstage hands. They had 130 dressers, 4,000 staff in the stadium. Teams included pop art, the arts, glamour, and worryingly, Eastern. Each with 50 models. That's 300 models. Showing off everything they had sort of come up with since 1958 on a catwalk designed to look like the sky. It took 15 minutes, and they had music by various largely French artists, including future First Lady of France, Carla Bruni.
No way.
And apparently, this is just as the internet was becoming wider spread and there was sort of international broadcast TV was becoming as far-reaching as it was. So the New York Times wrote an article about this saying that this fashion show symbolised that Paris haute couture has finally embraced the small screen. And basically after that, fashion shows began to be broadcast on TV. But I've gone back to the past for some of my... research, and I've looked at some of the progenitors of people who gave us live modelling and catwalks in general. Charles Frederick Worth, heard of this dude?
I recognise the name, I don't know where from.
He was basically the first, his fashion house, Worth and Boberg, which he founded in 1858, was the first to use live models to promote his garments to clients on a, in a sort of a regular, large scale. Mm-hmm. He also was the first person to sew branded labels into his clothes.
Hmm.
Right?
No, it wasn't him. It was actually his mum who did it to make sure they didn't get lost.
He was originally a sales assistant at an outlet called Gagelin, Opiges and Co., where he met his wife, Marie Vernet, who was also modelled for him very early on. Mm-hmm. And when he set up his fashion house, apparently she was really instrumental in the buying and selling of clothes and hiring a lot of the designers and staff as well. In this first shop he was working in, Gagelin, they were famous for their shawls, apparently, which were like an essential item in the 1850s.
And today.
Yeah, and today. Yeah, Lucy came here wearing an excellent shawl. And they would have shop assistants put the shawls on to demonstrate what they'd look like. And he pressed them to open a dress department, which he eventually did. And he started selling dresses and he became very well known in Paris. In fact, his ideas were a little bit, as an Englishman, he was a little bit too much for his Parisian employers. Apparently, there was an article in the Times celebrating the centenary of his fashion house opening, and it said, "The young Worth, full of ideas, was having such a success at Gagelin's that it was felt necessary to restrain his rashness."
Ooh.
Yeah. And he, as I say, when he opened his store, he had people parade around in the shop to show what his designs would look like. In the 1860s, his wife Marie and one of his best clients, the Princess de Metternich, they would launch his collections at Longchamp Racecourse. So at the race meetings, they would come down and wander around in his new designs. He'd deliberately send them to big social events, and the races, particularly at this time, were the big fashionable event. So people would see them in the clothes and then... they go, "Oh, you must go to the store to try his design."
I mean, that's cleverly done, but what, you know, if I'd been to a race meet, I'd go down to a designer and go, like, "I saw this thing at a race meet. It was beautiful. It was sort of like squares. Like, one was pink and the other was lime green. And
I think it was
like
silk.
It had a great matching hat.
Yes, absolutely. And a whip for some reason.
Yeah, it was accessory. Yeah.
It was delightful, but, you know, the person, they zoomed past me. Also, do you have any bridles?
He was selling dresses for 300 francs when he started out. By the time he got royal patronage, one of his last bills he issued to the Princess de Metternich was for one dress for 2,247 francs.
Wow.
So that's over seven times the price of his dresses when he started.
Wow.
Have you heard of Lucille?
Lucille?
No.
As in the woman who Little Richard sung about?
No, and not Lucille Ball either. This is Lucy Duff Gordon. Lucille Limited is considered to be the first internationally successful couture business. It had houses in London, New York, Chicago and Paris from the 1890s to the 1910s. And in her shop in Paris, for example, she sold items to Mata Hari, the World War One spy.
Amazing.
She also sold accessories, and she is probably the first house to have an in-house fragrance as early as 1907.
Wow.
Yeah, about 50 years before Coco Chanel. She built up a reputation for herself by designing costumes for theatre. So by having people like Lily Elsie and Gertie Miller and all these great sort of British and American stage actresses wear dresses she designed, it then drove business towards her couture. And but she was quite bad at making money. She was always on the verge of bankruptcy because a lot of her wealthy clients were wealthy in land but not necessarily in money. And she married, as I'll tell you shortly, an aristocrat, and she was quite bad at asking her friends to pay their bills. She promoted her fashion in the media. From about 1910, she wrote a weekly column for the Heart newspaper syndicate, monthly columns for Harper's Bazaar and Good Housekeeping, had Vogue, Vanity Fair, Les Modes, Femina and the London magazine feature her clothing. And in 1917, she entered into a contract to design the interiors of luxury cars for Chrysler.
Wow.
As well.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, she's amazing. Other people who bought her clothes were Margot Asquith, the mistress of the Prince of Wales, the Countess of Warwick, the Vanderbilts, dancers at the Ballet Russe, Lily Langtry, Sarah Bernhardt, Mary Pickford, famous actresses of the day.
Wow.
And she designed costumes for the Ziegfeld Follies, the reviews on Broadway. Amazing. As well. But her life is the most interesting. And before I get to her fashion shows...
I want this play. This is amazing.
At the age of 21, she ignored, and I'm quoting her, advice, and married the alcoholic and serial philanderer James Stuart Wallace.
Good for her.
Not only he, but she went and had some sexual affairs with people. Good for her. Her husband left her for a dancer, and she moved in with her mother with her daughter and began supporting herself by doing dressmaking at her, you know, in her, from her mother's house. She made a chiffon tea gown for a politician's wife, which caused a sensation apparently at a party this wife wore it at. And suddenly she got people coming to her for business, and she was able to open a store near the Burlington Arcade in Savile Row in central London. In 1900, she married Scottish baronet and sportsman Sir Cosmo Duff Gordon.
What a great
Do
name.
You recognise that name?
Cosmo Duff Gordon.
The Duff Gordons feature in the film Titanic.
Is it that the one who Billy Zane?
No. Lady Duff Gordon, as she then became, and Cosmo, were on the Titanic in 1912 when it sank. She was wearing a mauve silk kimono and squirrel coat when the boat was going down.
Hang on, a squirrel coat is in a coat made from squirrels?
Yes.
Of course.
And live squirrels. She would just, like Iron Man, she'd put her arms out and the pieces would assemble around her. She, Sir Cosmo, her maid, and 9 other people escaped in a lifeboat, which should have held 40 people.
Fucking hell.
Oh, yeah. Well, the thing is, it was actually Leonardo DiCaprio and his 39 brothers and sisters who were on the outside. They're like, sorry, no room for you in here.
Yeah. As the Titanic went down, apparently Lucy said to her maid, there goes your lovely nightgown. By the way, they were portrayed by Martin Jarvis and Rosalind Ayers. They're in the film Titanic. Martin Jarvis and Rosalind Ayers play them. Sir Cosmo, they were separated and estranged, but they never divorced. But he died in 1931 of natural causes and is buried, Ben, at Brookwood Cemetery in Woking.
Which is the end of the line of the London Necropolis Railway.
Yes, which we talked about in our recent podcast. He was buried there. But the thing we want to talk about is her fashion shows. She is said to have been the first person to have trained professional models to get people to wear and walk properly in her clothes. She got young women in their late teens into corsets, gave them lessons in charm and deportment. They would be typically working class women who, at the fashion shows, were not allowed to speak because their accents would endanger the effect she wanted to project. The dresses were called gowns of emotion. She gave them names like Give Me Your Heart, The Sighing Sound of Lips Unsatisfied, and When Passion's Thrall Is O'er. And they were worn
by models. They sound like Mills and Boone novels, right? Don't they?
But they were worn by models whose real names were probably like Gertie and Elsie and Lily. But she gave them names like Hebe, Coruscante, and Gamella.
Those are so much uglier.
She's said to have basically, because of her work in theatre, she had the idea of creating like a curtain, a stage, and foot lighting, and all of the theatrical backdrop for these mannequin parades, they were called, in her shops. So she'd invite Grand London ladies to her store, and they'd be served tea and handed a list of the models and the dresses like a theatre programme, and have the models walk up and down. And the other thing she did was some of her clothes were quite racy for the day. They had like little like lace apertures in them, or like you could see a little bit of ankle. And so single men would come to these fashion shows as well. Because there was the thought of maybe there'd be a bit of flesh to be seen.
Gosh, really? I mean, obviously, in my mind, they're quite pervy, and back in that day, pretty tricky to do some upskirting.
Yeah.
You know, you've got to set up the tripod and then get a sort of pulley system for the woman.
Yeah. When the flashbulb goes off, they set on fire.
She also held summer fashion shows in her garden, where the models would sometimes lead around pedigreed dogs on jewelled leads.
Oh my God.
And if they were held in the evening, they'd walk across at the theatrically lit stage with the music played by a string ensemble.
Love it.
As she said, the purpose of these parades was to lure women into buying more dresses than they could afford. So, you know,
that's
it's honest,
still how they work today.
Honest of her. And one more legend I want to talk about is Paul Poiret. A man once described by Jean Cocteau as looking like a huge chestnut. So, there you go. If you want to know what he looked like, it was that. But his designs were so famous that in the 1910s, Margot Asquith, the wife of the Prime Minister, had him display his designs at 10 Downing Street itself. In 1911, the publisher Lucien Vogel basically encouraged a photographer called Edward Steichen to promote fashion as a fine art in the magazine Art et Décoration, because at the time no one really knew where fashion fell in the world of the arts. So Steichen took photos of gowns designed by Poiret with interesting backlights and from inventive angles, and they were published in the April 1911 edition of the magazine, and according to historian Jesse Alexander, it's now considered the first ever modern fashion photography shoot.
Wow.
Where the garments were sort of being considered for their artistic quality as much as anything else. Poiret fell on hard times. When his fortunes were really low, his friends collected 40,000 French francs to help him out. Apparently he spent it on a lot of cru champagne, a refrigerator and a telescope.
Good for him.
Maybe to do that upskirting you mentioned, Ben. But I have a word. These also are like quite amazing
events.
These
are great, yeah.
The world's worst fashion show, as far as I'm concerned, took place a little more recently in September 2016 during New York Fashion Week. I read a New York Post article about the event. It was Kanye West's Yeezy Season 4 fashion collection, where the shoes were so badly made, and the article even says the stilettos were, inverted commas, designed by Kanye, that they practically disintegrated under the model's feet as they walked down the makeshift runway. The event, which started nearly 2 hours late, was staged on the grounds of a long-abandoned smallpox hospital on Roosevelt Island.
Amazing.
The guests had to get, obviously, buses from central New York, like the different reporters and models and influencers and so on. They were trapped on the buses waiting for Yeezy to arrive. At least one model fainted because of the heat. Basically, they were told to meet their bus in central New York at 1:30 p.m. for a 3 o'clock show. Kanye apparently maybe had a car crash or something on the way there, so the event was pushed back till 4. It didn't start until basically 5 o'clock. Someone on the Yeezy Season 4 bus was quoted as saying, "It feels like we're being kidnapped." And basically the setup for it was, there's like a triangular runway on this lawn for models to walk down, but then there were loads of models standing around in nude leotards just in amongst the catwalk, and they were standing for 3 hours because this thing was so late out in 80 degree heat. Some of them decided to just fucking sit down, in fairness to them. Others were falling over and teetering. Eventually some water was handed out to them. One of the bus's bathrooms broke down, so people were trapped on this bus without being able to take a piss. And then the great thing is that when they eventually did start, there's videos of a model in a hoodie and slacks nearly falling over while the heels are coming off. One model just took a shoe off and lobbed it off. She's like, "There's the point is wearing them," and she just stomps down the runway in her bare feet. It's great. It's really funny. Stella Bugby, who is an editorial director at The Cut, tweeted, "The most awful thing I've ever seen at New York Fashion Week. This is shameful and horrible, and I regret coming." The fact that it was in a smallpox hospital, it was 2 hours late, it was blazing hot, and then the shoes fell apart. It's a perfect storm.
It really is. And also, I have to tell you as well, Jean-Paul Gaultier's hip-hop album is equally awful.
Start by talking about the worst fashion show that I ever saw.
Okay, you've been to some. Good.
Well, I'm like very, very few, but I once went to one while I was skiing in Italy, which was insane. It, like, I was on a chairlift, and it went over this bar. There was a terrace outside this bar that normally had tables kind of spread out. And as I was going over on the chairlift, they were moving them into a kind of catwalk.
Right.
And people were kind of skiing down to it. Then, as the chairlift keeps going up, there's a little kind of duck trail of ski school kids.
Right.
That this skier cuts off. And the ski instructor leaves behind his class, skis after this guy, catches him and punches him right in the face, which was amazing. And then this bunch of little, like, 4-year-old ski school kids have to just, like, ski down to him and basically, like, try and stop this fight that's happening in the snow, which was insane. That's not part of the catwalk story, but it just
a lovely detail.
Sets the tone. Yeah. So we kind of get off the ski lift, ski down past this fight that's still going on, decide to see what's happening in the bar. And by the time we get there, the tables have all been set up into a catwalk. People are kind of sat along the sides in all of their ski gear and everything. And then these women in bikinis and underwear just, like, come out from this, like, mountain restaurant that normally just does, like, spaghetti bolognese and beer, and get up on the tables and start kind of parading up and down while really loud music is playing. Like, everyone's just a person like me. It's not like people have been invited to this show. I have no idea how they were planning on selling any of it. Yeah. Like, it was entirely context-free. Just gratuitous semi-nudity on the side of a mountain.
It was some big, like, mass hysteria event that just took place.
Insane. Skiing in Italy is its own thing. But yeah, it was mad. And it went on.
It wasn't like a particular line?
Have absolutely no idea. There was no advertising around it. There were no pamphlets. It was genuinely completely context-free. Went on, as you say, about 10 minutes of these poor girls in, like, it was fucking snowing earlier that day. Like, it was freezing cold. And they're all just kind of parading up and down and posing in tiny, tiny, tiny underwear. And then all sort of shuffle back into the restaurant, and then
that is amazing.
The day just kept going.
Do you think it was just a really upmarket version of Hooters? That
quite possibly that was it.
Hotels.
Yeah, hotels.
But yeah, that just kind of set the tone for like how much I love the absurdity of fashion shows. In you know, there's no way it's in any way connected to real life.
It is really mad how it's just like, here's a stage, here's a lot of loud music, and we're either going to go two ways. One, the models have to look immensely serious.
Yeah.
Or the Victoria's Secret route, where the models are like laughing and high-fiving each other as they walk past each other all the time while glitter falls down.
Yeah. Well, thank you for bringing up Victoria's Secret.
Oh, you're welcome.
Because I put all of my feminist credentials aside for a moment. I fucking love the Victoria's Secret fashion show. I love it so much. It's so absurd. And it's like, the thing is, it breaks so many traditions of the Victoria's kind of fashion show mold, because it goes on for ages.
Yes.
And it's one that, like, for weeks beforehand, they're doing like little kind of promo bits of it, and it is something that like is watched worldwide.
Yeah.
It's in the best and absolute fucking worst sort of way, it's everywhere. It's entirely toxic. It's awful. The thing that I hate about it, or the thing that is the worst about it, is it's not happening anymore.
They
were asked to diversify their models, and they were like, give me liberty or give me death.
Liberty, by the way, is a 6-foot-tall leggy Asian.
They were like, rather than make this in any way appropriate for the modern era, fuck you all, we're not doing it again. We're ruining our fun.
That's amazing. My only exposure to it is every time I fly at the airport, there's always a Victoria's Secret.
Yeah.
And the makeup of a Victoria's Secret store is it's wide open door, like the storefront is wide open, and the far wall is it's massive TV screen showing the show.
Yeah.
And you basically have all the dads who are on holidays sitting in the seats nearest that shop as they wait in the departures lounge, sort of trying to navigate that tight walk of, you know, reading their book but not being caught, just staring at whoever is. And they have that very particular, like, really, like, lifting my foot up and crossing and crossing in front of the other one.
Walk. That is the walk. That is...
It's like someone with chopsticks who's never used them before chasing a noodle around on a plate.
There is a reason for that walk. This is me telling on myself. I have walked in catwalk shows.
Actually got her!
And, like, it's... There is a reason for it. It makes your hips sway in a specific way. It makes your ass look a lot better.
Right.
It's also weirdly easier to balance.
If you're wearing like 6-foot stilettos.
Yeah, and there is something in like having your feet cross over just a little bit kind of weirdly balances out the wobble of like those shoes. Like, you have put them on for the first time maybe 10, 15 seconds before. They like... You know, you tell them a week or two in advance, like, this is my shoe size. But, like, they're not always right. They're not, you know, like, they're fucking hard to walk in.
And they've got to look brand new. You can't have someone wear them in.
Yeah, they've got to look perfect. Yeah, and, you know, you'll never wear them again. They're not things that you can practice in.
Yeah.
You know, or you wear them in rehearsal, but, like, your rehearsal is real quick.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so it is, like, the walk is something I will defend. Yeah. Because and I also, like, I love when models fall down. I like it's great, but, like, I love it because it is really human, yeah, you know? Yeah, and it's something where, like, the whole kind of aesthetic of catwalk shows is inhuman in every way, you know? And, like, Naomi Campbell falling down at Vivian Westwood made her career. Yeah. Like, that was, a defining moment in fashion because she fell down and she laughed instead of pretending that it didn't happen and, like, staying serious.
Yes, yeah.
And it's why she's one of the biggest supermodels that's ever existed, is because she was human in that moment.
Yeah.
To come back to Victoria's Secret, most catwalk shows, the models are, to a certain extent, supposed to be sort of anonymous. Like, sure, obviously there are supermodels, and, like, if Kate Moss walks in your show, everyone knows it's Kate Moss, you know?
But the thing is, like... No, she's like Saddam Hussein. She has, like, lots of lookalikes.
Yes, yeah. You know, the fact that models used to be called mannequins, yes, like, you know, they're not supposed to be seen as human beings with thoughts and feelings. They're supposed to be avatars, so you can see yourself in that dress, even though they are a foot taller and, like, 5 stone lighter than you are. The thing about Victoria's Secret is they do try and do the opposite, yeah, right? And, like, I mean, it's insane. They have this whole hierarchy of models there where, like, they have the models who are, like, just walking in the underwear, and then they have ones that are, like, on their way to being angels.
Oh,
and then they have the Victoria's Secret angels.
I wonder, because they're always wearing those angel wings.
Yeah, well, the thing is, they're not all always wearing the angel wings. Like, earning your wings is, like, a legit fucking thing.
No way.
Women have, like, there's videos of women being given their wings and literally crying. Like, it's a huge fucking thing.
Did Hugh Hefner have that with the bunny ears for Playboy?
It does feel the same kind of, like, every time a teenage boy smiles, a Victoria's Secret angel get their wings.
Did you change the word from smiles there? Yeah, I think that's the euphemistic thing.
I was trying to stay faithful to the original quote.
Yes. I think Hosier played at one of the last ones I did. And there was, like, huge outcry going, you're, like, he's this big advocate for equality and LGBT rights and women's rights and stuff. But also, I was like, is Hosier's music really, like, the upbeat vibe that Victoria's Secret wants?
Yeah. I mean, like, Taylor Swift did it and, you know, played a whole gig, and, you know, she has her whole squad of women, most of whom are Victoria's Secret models anyway. So, like, that made sense. But that is the thing, like, it's not just a fashion show, it's like a full gig. It takes on this form in a kind of wider cultural sense.
It's sort of embraced its overblown nature. Yeah.
I think there's something joyous and terrible about that, you know? It is not healthy, and it probably should have died a long time ago, and I'm very, very sad. I wanted to talk a little, like, we were talking earlier about kind of inventing new items of clothing.
Oh, yeah.
Which brings me to Alexander McQueen, and who is an absolute genius, and revolutionized many, many, many things.
I never realized how good he was. There was the V&A exhibition of him.
Oh my god! Yeah,
like 4 or 5 years ago, and I knew the name, and in my mind, I was, like, prepared for it to be like the Zoolander wanky exhibition.
Yeah,
and it was astonishing.
Yeah,
how talented and inventive and affecting some of the clothes were.
Yeah.
They were absolute works of art. And not... It's weird. Like, they were definitely impractical, but not pretentious. They were incredible.
Yeah. He was a visionary and a genius. Like, incredible.
I like walking past his store.
Yeah.
I would never walk into it. Logically, I think, because they've got a security guard outside the front anyway. I think they just go, no, you're not coming in.
Sorry.
Come on, let's be honest. You're not going to buy anything in here.
One of McQueen's slightly less well-advised inventions were bumster trousers.
Excuse me?
So you've maybe heard of, like, a hipster...
I have.
...hipster cut? Yeah. So bumsters are just slightly lower rise than that. They give you bum cleavage. They are, like, have you, you know, the very first episode of Nathan Barley,
There's
a girl walking down the street, and it's just like a shot, but her jeans are so low that you can see, like, a little tuft of pube come out the top. That, in my mind, is a direct reference to
bumsters.
To bumsters, and to, like, McQueen had a collection called Highland Rape.
Oh, I didn't. Yeah. Alexander.
Which was, I mean, it was supposedly about how the British sacked Scotland, and, you know, it was a political statement rather than kind of a sexual statement. But the clothes all sort of looked like they had been ripped off the models in certain ways. And it was the first place that the Bumster trouser was introduced. And
it's such a horrible name. It sounds like a nickname that a bunch of teenage boys would give their mate who has claimed to have a lot more anal sex than he's actually had.
They are ridiculous. They're completely absurd. Also, like, the models, because the clothes look like they've been ripped off them, they were walking down the catwalk, like, holding their own boobs because their tops had fallen off. It was not the strongest choice by McQueen.
Because then they presumably all have to go commando.
Yes, they do. Yes, they do.
So do you think, like, the style for having your boxers on show with a low-rise jean was, like, the forefather of that?
I think it's just that most models are so thin that they don't have chest cleavage.
Okay.
So it's a way of having cleavage on, like, you know, 16-year-old anorexic girls is to just, like, move the cleavage elsewhere.
It's cleavage envy,
yeah, I think is what it is. But you bringing up people going commando brings me to what I think is the worst fashion show ever, which is Rick Owens' Spring Summer 2015, or as it is popularly known, hashtag Dick Owens, where it was a menswear collection where the clothes had strategically placed peepholes, let one say.
I remember this.
Where, like, they were basically specifically built so that you could see all of the dicks. So all of the male models were walking down the catwalk, breezy and free.
I've just seen one.
Yeah. Oh yeah. There's some peen on show in this show. It was, I mean, the worst thing about it is the clothes are ugly. Things McQueen had done, even if there was nudity, the clothes were spectacular. With Rick Owens in 2015, the clothes were really ugly and were seemingly just built to show off some penises.
They look like they're wearing leather bin bags.
Yeah,
it's kind of like hair shirt chic.
Yeah.
Like they're all, you know, early Christian.
Hair shirt
chic
was a member of the Gestapo, wasn't it?
Yeah, hair shirt chic, yes. No, they all look like early Christian hermits who've just come out for a walk around.
It's
The thing I'm liking about it, because I'm clicking through several of these photos, the unfortunate thing is I don't know how cold the models are feeling or how poorly endowed some of them are. A lot of the holes aren't as effective as they should be.
Yeah.
They're just there, but actually there isn't that much penis.
Yeah. Well, I think that's, like, you know, sort of as they walk, you maybe catch a glimpse. It's,
yes.
You know, it's like the high fashion version of the can-can.
The way it's ending as well, like the choreography is awful as well. So it's ending with some sort of weird conga line where they're all getting together and acting in this absolutely demented way.
It's like Starlight Express of the dance.
Yeah.
The only reason that high fashion has kind of continued to exist in the way that it does is because no one feels safe to laugh at it.
Yeah.
And I think with this show in particular, like, before the show had even ended, it had sparked a hashtag, you know? Like, there was no way of getting around how ridiculous it was. And Rick Owens was kind of talking about how female nudity is, like, relatively commonplace in high fashion. If you go to museums, then you see kind of these beautiful marble sculptures and, you know, the male nudity there is artistic.
It's a fair point.
Which is a very fair point. The way he manifested that in his show was imprecise.
It is. And it's, and it's tricky because... How can I phrase this delicately? I'm not sure I can. Like, female nudity is better than male nudity. And I'm not just
I hate to disagree with you.
I'm not just saying that from a heterosexual point of view. I feel like talking not just even aesthetically, geometrically, the shapes that the female naked body give are better than the shapes the male naked body is. I mean, essentially what I'm saying is that I prefer spheres to cylinders.
I think that's a very biased viewpoint.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But, you know, but I can Yeah, I can see what you mean.
I don't. Well, because let's face it as well. Not, of course, that all breasts are uniform, or indeed that all vaginas are uniform. But I think they're better shapes than, because a dick isn't just like a cylinder and a couple of spheres hidden in a little scraggly bag.
God's first design.
It was.
Actually, to streamline these.
How can I put it? You might find penises appetizing, but I disagree with you if you find them aesthetically beautiful.
We can agree to disagree.
So first of all, I found out about someone who, I don't know, I think that he was doing sort of like his own roast of the fashion world. A chap that I've never heard of before. He's a critic, a designer, a TV and radio personality called Richard Blackwell. And Richard Blackwell famously in 1960 created a list of the 10 worst dressed women. And it was an annual award that he presented every January.
Right.
Yeah, obviously. An awful guy.
He was a man who could see feminism coming and thought, I'm going to get this in first.
Yeah, real donkey punch of a list, isn't it?
Yeah, because no one does them anymore.
Yeah,
you
exactly,
know,
yeah.
We've solved that.
Yeah.
But, well, I am obviously going to share some of his descriptions.
Please do.
Who did he have on the list? That's what I want to know.
He described
Eleanor Roosevelt.
Eleanor of Aquitaine.
Yeah.
Joan of Arc. Charcoaly. He described Martha Stewart as dull, dowdy, and devastatingly dreary.
Wow.
Cher as a million beads and one overexposed derriere.
This isn't all in 1960. These are down the years.
These are
right?
down the years,
okay,
yeah. Queen Elizabeth, was she the palace Christmas tree or just a royal clown? Winona Judd, I don't know who Winona Judd is, but he described her as looking like Hulk Hogan in sequins.
Oh, man.
Another one on Martha Stewart, she dresses like the centrefold of the Farmer's Almanac. And last
That's
of all...
That's a compliment, surely.
Yeah. It depends what's in the centrefold of the Farmer's Almanac. If it's a combine harvester, not so much. The Dixie Chicks, they look like a trio of truck stop fashion tragedies trapped in a typhoon.
Yeah.
But here's
to
the thing.
To be fair, the Dixie Chicks would probably take them.
Yeah.
Obviously, the popularity has waned, thankfully.
Mm.
But it was sort of a bit of a who's who to be on. It was like a bit like I say, being roasted. It was done sort of with affection. So he says that he's had personal missives from Dolly Parton, Mariah Carey, and the country singer Tanya Tucker to say thank you for being on the list.
Mm.
So it's done with a little bit of tongue-in-cheek.
So what we've learned about Richard Blackwell there is that he doesn't understand sarcasm.
There we are. Right there. I looked at odd places where fashion shows have taken place.
Oh, yeah.
A chap called Tom Brown chose the Vigorelli Velodrome in Milan for a cycling influence show.
Amazing.
Hang on. Were they all having to walk in like 45 degrees?
Yeah.
Right. No, they just had to do it really fast.
Yes. Yeah. Well, no, they did it in groups of four, and then the back one would have to overtake the front one very slowly.
With Chris Hoy and Jason Kenny on their backs.
Yeah, yeah. Have you seen that?
I've written one all of them.
There's, and then of course there's the pursuit event where two models of different fashion houses are chasing after each other. No, the pursuit event is where someone is wearing furs and Peter are 180 degrees and chasing them round and round. That reminds me, I can't remember the name of the fashion designer, but there was a mad fashion show a few years ago of I think it was almost entirely women, but the female models, they were wearing another woman strapped upside down.
Yes, oh my god, it was amazing.
I mean, it was meant to be representative of the way that women had to carry each other to lift each other up, and it was just like, just write an essay, mate.
I hate to break it to you guys, that was Rick Owens again.
Oh no!
See, he can be great!
Well, this one actually sounds quite fun. They were riding bikes. They were playing Bicycle Race by Queen. It was sort of retro cycling chic. Another one. This is quite a lovely story. Martin Margiela, he put on a catwalk show in Paris in 1989, and he did it in a children's playground. And he asked for permission from the local parents, and they said only on the condition that the kids can come and watch.
Oh yeah,
and the kids were the models were wearing flowing white clothing, and some of the children saw it and got up and began playing with the models.
Oh.
And suddenly, like the models, sort of like Naomi Campbell, you were saying before, just like their icy exterior broke, and they just started giggling and all playing with the kids.
Cute.
It was really sweet, really cute. At the other end of that, this is in Charlotte, North Carolina in 2011, at a gay and transgender fashion show contest. One member of the fashion show was angry that they hadn't got to the final and started a riot. And, my favourite bit of the riot is like chairs are being thrown in this local hall, and one woman sees a chair, pops it down, picks up an entire trestle table like she's at a wrestling match and throws it into the into the whirlpool of anger. It's glorious.
You can mess with us, guys.
Yeah.
God damn it if we don't win fashion shows.
I had a little look at animal fashion shows. If you go to the Fancy Rat Convention...
that how is... can I go to that?
Please do.
Go to fancyrat.com.
Great, I will.
Sorry, it is the NFRS, the National Fancy Rat Society.
Which nation... is this a National Fancy Rat Society of?
So it is a British-based club for rat fanciers that promote fancy rat exhibitions, as well as the study and breeding of rats.
Is it like Crofts for rats?
Pretty much. Yeah, crats. they publish a bi-monthly journal called Pro Rat A. I don't know if it's a...
like pro-rata.
Oh! That's an awful pun.
Is it free?
No, I think you've got to pay to
now then it's not. Then it's not a good pun. Yeah. That's not a good pun.
No. There is also publicity for them in a magazine called Fur and Feather.
It's Fox and Hound, but sort of the after.
Yeah. They have started staging shows where that you can dress up your pet rat. There's a woman called Arda Neves who has dressed her rats in little tuxes, wedding dresses, bridesmaids gowns. Some of these even like cost like between $80 and $120.
Amazing.
It's sort of cute, but sort of awful at the same time.
Do you know there are beauty pageants for camels?
Go on.
Yeah. I think it's a lot of places, but Saudi Arabia has, for example, the annual King Abdulaziz Camel Festival. It's just like Miss World, but for camels.
Amazing.
How do you rate a beautiful camel?
Well, they do it by, like, they look at their teeth and the shape of the hump and the nose and their height. Yeah, their eyes. Small ears, apparently, is quite important.
Yeah.
And having a really full mouth.
Yeah.
Apparently in 2018, 12 camels were disqualified after receiving Botox injections to pump up their lips.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
There were 26,000 camels came that year, so 12 out of 26,000 is pretty small. Like, you know, compared to the Olympics drug testing rates, I think it was pretty short. Yeah, the festival that lasts like over 30 days. Beauty contests.
Amazing.
Good Lord above. I don't know who won the most recent, RuPaul's Rat Race. The other animal fashion show that I found out is that in Griffin, Georgia in 1951, there was a turkey fashion show. Before the turkeys were going to be killed for Thanksgiving, they were dressed up as a famous football player, a beauty queen, and the worst of all, there was a turkey that was dressed as Snow White with her chicks playing the Seven Dwarves.
Oh,
and the narrator on the film says, "And here come her chicks, soon to be orphans."
God, the 50s people just had no sentiment, didn't they?
No.
Did like the winner of the fashion show get pardoned, or were they all...
No, this wasn't the White House.
They got a garland around the neck. The garland was made up of garlic, thyme, rosemary.
For my decision, we're going to go online, and I'm going to talk about something called digital fashion. Let me describe it for you.
Please tell me this is esports, but for fashion designers.
Pretty much.
Oh my God.
I've never seen you more excited.
So, obviously, when you go to, like, a boutique, you can look at something and go, that's lovely, you know, I think I might want to buy it for Christmas, then you just give it a cost several £1,000. So instead, what you can do is you can provide a photograph of yourself, pay them some money, and then the digital fashion designers will Photoshop their clothes onto you so you can look like you're able to shop at high-end fashion designers.
Oh my God. That's amazing. God.
They will... So, one of the most famous designers of these, they're called Carlings, probably the best digital designers in the world. Yeah. Oh shit, that's Carlsberg. The joke still stands. Their first collection was called Neo X, and the collection was inspired by the video game Tekken. Featuring a bright yellow crocodile skin coat, blue latex chaps covered in computer print code, and a black visor emblazoned with the slogan, "Eat the Glitch."
Wow.
I want all of those.
Yeah.
But you can have them, apparently.
Yeah, they cost between 9 and 30 quid.
That's how much it takes them to Photoshop some clothes onto you.
Yeah.
I mean, that's reasonable.
It is pretty reasonable,
In the world of Instagram, I imagine business is booming, is it?
Yeah, it really is. It's all about the Instagram influencers. The Kiki Person, who's the brand manager at Carling, says...
Her name is Kiki Person.
Kiki Person.
She's a big fan of Tekken. Yeah. Just have one combo over and over again.
She makes some sort of reasonable point by selling the collection for 15 quid an item. We've democratised the economy of the fashion industry.
But you haven't. You're not giving people clothes.
Here, kick it out.
Okay.
And at the same time, open up the world to taking chances with your styling without leaving a negative carbon footprint.
No, but you're photoshopping clothes onto people. Did they then photoshop them into, like, the foreground to the red carpet at fancy events?
No, that's how you pay the money and then they photoshop the clothes onto you.
Oh, but then they could charge a premium and they got, like, an extra 50 quid and they'll photoshop you in the clothes onto the red carpet at the Oscars.
Yeah, I guess they could do that as well. You mentioned influencers. Daria Simonova, who modelled the collection's puffer jacket and lightning bolt embellished jeans to her 58,000 followers, said she'd definitely buy more digital clothing in the future.
So... do the clothes actually exist in any sense, or are they purely digital?
They are purely digital.
That's
mad. So, last May in New York, the world's first piece of digital couture was sold at a charity auction for how much, my friends?
They're going to sell what? Sorry.
Digital couture.
They're going to sell JPEGs. Off the JPEG.
Excuse me, PDFs.
Okay. I think... can I know what the item of clothing is?
You can indeed. It was an iridescent, translucent one-piece designed by Amber J. Sluten. I'll even show you a picture of it. There we are. There's a little picture of it. Do you want to describe it to the listeners?
Is that a picture of someone pretending to wear this?
Yes.
It looks like a rain poncho.
Or a jellyfish has swallowed a woman.
Yeah. I'm going to go $8,000.
Charity, you say this was for? Okay, so people will pay.
Oh, yeah, fuck.
$50,000.
Lucy was much closer, £7,500.
Fucking hell.
Yeah.
To own that PDF.
And listen, it's gone to charity, so all well and good. There's another designer who said that we'll have to start building an entirely different relationship with our clothes. With the proliferation of high street stores where everybody is pumping out huge volumes, every store's the same, it makes the world very boring. I think the element of exclusivity that you could create through digital clothing is something that could build that desire and actually return a sense of how we used to shop. Get fucked, you snake oil wanker.
Okay, well, this is like the natural progression, though. We've had digital books or e-books, which you don't have the physical book, you read it on a screen. Now we've got the digital clothes, where you don't actually have the clothes, you just put them on you in a photo of you. And then we're going to move over to your dream, Lucy, where we have digital food, where you don't eat anymore. Someone just, you know, sends you an email going, "You've just had lunch."
Great, I feel full. I mean, it's not going to stop fast fashion because the clothes are, like, people still need to buy and wear actual real clothes.
Yeah, well, no, the most awful thing about this is that in order to make the digital fashion, they've had to create sweatshops in Sims. So heartbreaking. So, our suggestions for the world's worst fashion show, Barry's example of a man leaping outside of his own area of expertise, Kanye West's Yeezy Season 4, Lucy's Schlongfest of Rick Owens' hashtag Dick Owens Spring Summer Collection, and my suggestion of the digital couture of the iridescence dress sold at the Fabricant charity auction for $9,500. Ladies and gentlemen, what an inverted pyramid of bullshit we've got here today. Tricky. Is it someone who's not a designer and has made something awful in an awful place? Someone who is a designer and has made... like, that really is Zoolander stuff. Or my suggestion that feels quite sweet spotty of fashion that is impossible to actually wear in the real world.
Yeah.
I feel like it's between me and Lucy to duke it out, really.
I feel like it. It's very easy to just laugh at models falling over. And Kanye West's increasing egomania.
Yeah, and yours is bad, but it's just dicks on show.
Yeah.
Whereas mine,
it's not just dicks on show.
Okay, it's the suggestion of dicks on show as well.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But
it's not the dicks; it's the space around the dicks. That's
where exactly. The jazz fashion.
Yeah. Jazz fashion.
But I'm sorry. As soon as I saw mine, I was like, "That is a winner."
Yeah.
Like,
unfair. Yeah.
The fact that it doesn't actually exist and people will pay money for it. It's just too perfect.
That's
so that
great.
Was the world's worst fashion show. Before we go, it's time for the world's worst news of the week. And for our suggestion this week, we go to the Metro newspaper, where there's the awful tale of one Keziah Josephiak, who is a mother of young Raf, who's 5 months old, and she was getting ready to go out for a meal with her boyfriend, and Raf wanted to be fed, so she got him ready for a bit of breastfeeding. And only after she took the baby off her breast did she realise that she had just put some fake tan on. And the baby had a little fake tan beard.
Oh my god.
I love it. He looks like Homer Simpson. That's amazing.
Yeah, he really does. I mean, the baby remained unharmed, yes. But how adorable.
Can we put that on the Twitter feed, please? But also, I have never worn fake tan. Do you ensure you put the tan all over, including on your areole?
I've never fake tan to that extent.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
To be fair,
I don't know where she was going for dinner.
We don't know.
We just don't know.
That's, yeah. I'm stumped by that question.
I feel like that's, like, I've, like, asked you, what? How do you, like, brush your teeth? It's like one of those things, like, you just do it and you don't
you
necessarily
do
know
it.
How you do
yeah.
it. Well, anyone who has worn fake tan at home, do let us know if you, you literally put them all over to avoid any you know, tan lines. We're interested.
Yeah, send us your fake tan pictures. before we go, Lucy, where can people find you and what can they find you doing when they get there?
People can find me on Twitter or on Instagram at Lucy Papuski, 2 O's and SKY. and they can find me directing things mainly. So Meet, which is my show that opened at Theatre 503 yesterday, it will be on until March 14th. Other things will happen that I'm not allowed to tell people yet.
But
I am very much on the Twitter and on the Instagram.
Smashing stuff. We are all off to launch our new range of fashion inspired by the songs of Vanilla Ice, hosted on Edinburgh's Plague Pits. Until next time, goodbye.
Bye. Bye.
Worst Foot Forward is part of Podnose, the UK's leading independent entertainment podcasting network. For episode archives of Worst Foot Forward and all of the shows on the network, visit us at www.podnose.com. You can also follow us on Twitter via @podnose or send us an email via admin@podnose.com.